Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to change a child's outlook for the future from bleak to bright? There are already significant strikes against the rural poor in developing countries, from a shortage of basic necessities like food and clean water to the lack of resources to fund quality education. But for an Indian baby named Pinky, born with a cleft palate, life promised to be even tougher. Ostracized by her peers and even by some adults, her parents feared she would never complete an education or get married. But they struggled just to feed their five children and could not imagine raising the money for corrective surgery. The girl's story is at the heart of this year's Academy Award-winning documentary short feature Smile, Pinky, which will debut on HBO on Wednesday, May 3rd. Its Texas-raised producer and director Megan Milan is here to talk about the project. Megan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
How did you decide that you wanted to tell this story?
Yeah. Well, the story actually came to me through the Smile Train, which is the nonprofit organization, U.S.-based organization, that supports the work of the doctor we profiled in the film and hundreds of doctors around the world. They work in 76 different developing countries with sort of a unique niche that they support local doctors rather than sending American medical teams abroad to do this very, very simple surgery. They empower local doctors to do it who can, you know, perform surgeries year round and, you know, often 7 days a week. And they came to me saying, we have a great idea for a documentary. And as a documentary filmmaker and probably as a journalist, you know, you get pitched ideas constantly. And I'm usually like, thanks, no thanks. I come up with my own ideas. But there, I don't know, you know, and it's always sort of being open to the story. Something just sort of grabbed my heart and my head together. Clefts really weren't on my radar. It was something I'd see the pictures in the Sunday newspaper and just sort of think, oh, that's too bad. But of all the world's problems, it just, you know, hadn't grabbed me. But when I started learning a little bit more and learning about how prevalent it is, that it's actually one of the most common birth defects in the world, and especially in developing countries, almost all children who are born with clefts live their whole life with a cleft. And then how really devastating it is, that it really goes beyond the cosmetic impact. But like you were saying, that, you know, the social ostracism is just devastating to a young life, and that there are speech impediments and nutrition problems as well. And then how curable it is. And you know, as someone who's interested in making social issue films, it's rare that I get into a story with a very probable happy ending. And that really drew me in. I liked the idea of a story that still was going to have layers to it and complexity, but would be a hopeful message in the end. And that's what it ended up being. And, you know, it's really fun to be able to share that kind of a story.
So how did it work for you in selecting? You have essentially two kind of central characters. You mm-hmm. have Pinky, and then you have a little boy,
Guturu.
Okay, Guturu. How did you pick them?
Yeah, well, I tell stories in observational, it's called cinema verite style, and really character driven. So your characters are everything. You get the character wrong and you have a flat film. But this one actually posed quite a challenge, because one of the opening scenes of the film is when Pinky and Guturu's families are meeting this social worker who's been out going door to door trying to find children with cleft. And when he's meeting with the families for the first time and letting them know that this is not something their child has to live with for the rest of their life, but actually there is a cure and it can be done quickly and for free. So, of course, that's a key scene. I want to be there filming, but I also didn't have the resources. It's an independent film. I didn't have the resources to be out in the field with the social worker for weeks on end. And even though there are a million children in India living with clefts, there's over a billion people in India. So it's a lot of work to find the children. So you have to get, you know, creative with your producing cap. And I was actually lucky enough to work with a great field producer, Indian field producer named Nandini Rajwadi. And she went out with one of the other social workers a few weeks before scouting. And sort of under the guise of being generic public health researchers. And so they would go village to village and ask what sort of health problems the children had. And clefts were one of them. And she sent me back a group of about 12 to 15 kids with little profiles of them and photographs. And Pinky and Guturu just sort of jumped off the page for me. And Pinky and her father, they had even noticed in their first meeting that they had a really special relationship, and that appealed to me. But it's always a bit of a gamble and a lot of gut. And, you know, we got there, and because it was unique this time around that I actually met them shooting. Usually, you know, we arrive without equipment, sit down, talk a while. Would you like to be part of a documentary? But in this case, it was a little bit different, because that first scene was so key. There's no recreating it. I mean, I don't do recreations, part of because I think the audience should get what they think they get, you know, should be real, but also because they never turn out as good as the real thing. So anyway, it was just a gamble, and it turned out great. Within minutes, I knew we had two young people with some, you know, some real sparkle to them.
Well, when you talk about wanting to sort of explore social issues through these smaller stories, mm-hmm. I think the amazing thing about this is that, of course, it's about the problem of cleft palates and healthcare, but it's also a story that really like slams you into what rural poverty is in India. The scene where Pinky and her father are going to go for this surgery and they have to walk for hours, she's got no shoes on her little feet.
Yeah. Well, that's part of why we call it, you know, a real world fairy tale. I mean, it's not, you know, life is dramatically improved for these children. I mean, they have a chance where they didn't. But they're still desperately poor children in India, just like you said in the intro. And so, I mean, where I'm drawn into stories, you know, I'm not sure there's exactly a rhyme or rhythm. You know, they sort of find me. But I mean, one common thing is that I do look for stories where the character can pull you into a reality that might be wildly different from your own, but try and find sort of small moments of commonality, because I, you know, fiercely believe we all have a lot more in common than we do different. So sort of those small moments that can be entry points, you know, Pinky and her father having a conversation the night before a surgery. Well, any father who loves his daughter is going to have that very similar tender conversation. Now, of course, the conversation might not be about the fact that they're going to have to walk for hours, you know, but still there would be that parent's love of their child, you know, or just the tending to the hair or trying to find pants because we're going to town, you know, just so I love to build films of lots of little moments that sort of build energy and emotion rather than sort of slamming you over the head with why this is important. So I hope that is what happens for the viewers.
Yeah, it's very tender when he says, well, it's a long walk, can you make it? And of course she's all excited, but he says, you know, if you get tired, I'll carry you.
Yeah. No, he's wonderful. I mean, it was we had endless scenes of him just being a really wonderful, nurturing father. And I think that's a level where a lot of people really connect with the film, because that feeling, that burden that a parent would feel of their child being born with something and they're having no resources to do anything about it, I think is something a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah, you know, Megan, another thing that really strikes me is all of these parents that we see, including the ones who aren't as prominently featured, clearly want the best for their kids. They want education for their kids. Their lack of education is so obvious when the social worker comes and they're talking about this problem and they say, oh, yeah, she has this because she was born, she was in utero during an eclipse.
Yeah. Well, there's
they have no idea what caused it.
No. And, you know, there's lots of superstitions. I've come to learn a whole lot about clefts that I never knew, which is one of the wonderful things about making a documentary. All of a sudden, this world is opened up to you. But there are different superstitions all around the world. I mean, the folks from the Smile Train will tell me, you know, that they're in different countries, they believe different things. But pretty uniformly, it's considered, you know, punishment of some form, you know, the family or the village or the child themselves has done something wrong. So here you are, you know, starting out your life and you're considered, you know, a scar on your village. And so, I mean, it takes a lot for the parents to even realize that it's a birth defect, that it's something that's curable. I mean, most of them think that this was, you know, intentionally for them having done something wrong. So one of the things that I love, though, about the way Pankaji, who's the main social worker we see in the film, and everybody at the hospital, is that they're not condescending to the families about, oh, you idiots, how could you have thought that? You're so naive. It's very respectful. And, you know, this is what you thought before. You had no one had told you anything but the fact that the eclipse is what caused this. And they, you know, they really spend the time to help them understand and to help them, you know, feel safe and confident that taking their child into the big city for surgery. I mean, you know, Pinky and her father had never been to the city before and really probably didn't have a clear idea what surgery was. So they just really take the time, you know, to sit down and have those conversations. And it's very labor intensive. I mean, I hope people who see the film can see that it's as much work to find the patients and to get out there as it is to actually do the surgery. In fact, the surgery is sort of it's not simple, but, you know, it's the easier part.
Well, you know, a really nice moment even in the beginning of the film is when the social worker is there sort of passing out these flyers, and there are crops of people, all of whom eagerly take this, and you can tell that they're thinking of someone, whether it's within their village or not, right, that they can pass this along to.
Right. No, and it's one, I mean, it's, I think it's a wonderful public health model. I mean, one of the great things about clefts is that it's, you know, unfortunately, so many of the problems in the developing world with health are such big, overwhelming problems, curing nutrition, you know, maternal, prenatal care and all. And this one has a quick fix to it. And they've really, you know, honed in on that. But I think there's all sorts of great trickle down that happen in the health sector and the communication about health just from, you know, getting out there and doing that. So like Pankaj will go, the social workers will go to the schools and, you know, and so I think there's a lot more education that happens too about ideas about difference, you know, and that it's that's you shouldn't judge someone just because they're born different and that this is nothing they've done wrong. You know, it's a very, you know, simple thing. So there's a nice and you know, the training that the nurses and anesthesiologists and assistant doctors in that hospital are getting, you know, many of them will go on to do other things that have nothing to do with class. But there's this great trickle down that happens for the health sector in the countries where these hospitals are.
Well, and Gutru's mother, initially, when they approach her, she's talked about having gone to see about this before and was so terrified by the prospect that she sort of picked up her baby and ran.
Right. So Gutru's mom, unlike Pinky's family, doesn't seem to really have a sense that the surgery could be done. But Gutru's mother, they had taken him to one of the government hospitals at the beginning, and I think we're just really afraid. And she's still afraid. And I love that about her, that she said, you know, my son might not be perfect. My son might be different, but he's my son and I love him. And you have to convince me this is the right thing to do for him. And then the social worker's reaction is, OK, I will convince you, you know, not like take it or leave it, lady. I'm the medical expert. You know, it's just really nurturing and really caring and so respectful. And I got the sense that, you know, these families they live in such difficult circumstances that there aren't a lot of people sitting down and listening what's going on in your life. And let me, you know, it's almost like a therapy session, which is such an indulgence, you know, that we all are able, you know, in this country to have. And that really someone sitting down and, you know, wanting to hear their life story and what their fears are. And it was really emotional for me, those scenes.
The other thing that I think is clearly illustrated in this, I think a lot of us can imagine having a child with a medical problem and not being able to afford the treatment. Just getting to where this free surgery is going to be performed is almost like that takes almost as much of a miracle as the surgery itself.
Exactly. I mean, the journeys, it was incredible that, you know, we stayed in Varanasi. It has two names, the city, Varanasi or Benares, a colonial name. But you know, it's a 2-hour drive by SUV to Pinky's village. But it's like going from, you know, 21st century to 17th century. And, you know, in the mornings I was video chatting with my nephew on my laptop. And a short drive later, I'm in a place with no running water, no electricity. They've never seen a 2-story building, you know, very isolated. Because if you're not going by SUV, you know, it's a many, many hours walk. And even the, you know, pennies that it would take to get a rickshaw. You know, Pinky and her dad take a rickshaw across the river, a little auto rickshaw thing. This is great vehicles. And you know, that's a large amount of money. And I was talking with Dr. Sabode, who's the surgeon in it and the head of the hospital that we filmed. And he talked about that they actually feel like it's sort of important for the parents to have that buy-in of sort of gathering up the funding to at least get there, that it's sort of their piece of commitment to it, but that it is really a struggle for a lot of families. And very often they'll give them the money to get home more easily, because especially after the kids have had surgery, they're feeling a little, you know, tender, and that's traumatic. But the folks with the Smile Train, which is the organization that funds not just the folks in the film, but the other, they are trying to make that a piece of it where they'll have enough funding to also help families get there, because really that transportation, I mean, the scene in the film, Gutru's mom says that she's borrowed some rupees, and it's the equivalent of like $8, and it's, you know, this huge, who did you borrow the money from? And you let him know, I'm giving my word, I'm giving a guarantee, I promise I'll pay it back, you know, and it's a huge sum of money for them. But, I mean, it's also an example of, I mean, they'll do whatever it takes to get this.
Megan Mylan is my guest. She's the Academy Award-winning filmmaker who produced the documentary short subject Smile Pinky, which will debut on HBO Wednesday, June 3rd. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment, and you are welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Megan Mylan. Her film Smile Pinky won the Academy Award this year for Best Documentary Short Subject. It will debut on HBO on Wednesday, June 3rd. I think I said May earlier. It's June 3rd. We would love for you to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I think, Megan, one of the most moving shots for me is when Pinky finally gets to the hospital and you see her sort of glance sidelong at another little girl whose deformity is very similar to hers. And you get the sense that she's never seen anyone else ever that looked like she did.
Yeah, I don't believe that she had. And I think that was common to a lot of the children and parents there. And then all of a sudden there's this moment where, you know, I thought I was the only one living like this. And you realize that there are other people who've shared, you know, the same burdens that you have. And I love that shot, too. It's one of my favorites in the whole film. And I was so happy, you know, that we were there and we saw it. And because she's just, you know, her eyes say so much. I always love moments that say a lot without any words. And this just felt like she went through a whole range of emotions of, oh, look at that girl. Oh, she looks like me. Is that me? And how I'm seeing her, is that how the world sees me? And then, you know, she takes her lip and sort of, or her tongue and sort of touches her lip. Mm-hmm. And you see her looking at the other girl and, you know, sort of dad's right there. So I think it did say a lot. And it's amazing that, you know, that a lot of the kids living in these rural villages do live really isolated. I mean, there might be someone, you know, over the hill who has the same affliction, but people don't move around that much. So they really often have not run into anyone else. And that moment in the film, I remember with my editor, there's sort of an awkward camera move in it. And when we did the first pass, she sort of only took half the shot. And I was like, no, take the whole thing. You know, and she's a great editor, but she was like, oh, but it's sort of, I was like, I don't care, you know, just stay on.
Well,
it.
And I have to say, I didn't even notice it watching.
No, of
you're
course,
so,
yeah.
First of all, Pinky's eyes, for people who haven't yet seen a picture of her, are so expressive, but just gorgeous. She's got these enormous black eyes, and she's just the most beautiful little girl.
Yeah, well, that was one of our lucks in casting is, I mean, the truth is Pinky was a beautiful little girl, even with a cleft lip, mm-hmm. you know, and pretty quickly after spending time with her, I sort of stopped noticing it, you know, and so the wonderful thing was then to see, you know, her exterior physical beauty sort of meet up with that interior beauty and the shine in those eyes, and it was just, you know, there was sort of no going wrong with her. That was luck in casting.
And I guess her surgery was just one part, but in many cases there are definitely kids at the hospital who are in worse shape than she and Gertrude both. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, they're there, I guess, for a matter of weeks.
Some kids, so there's sort of two very common things is you can have a cleft lip or a palate or both. And the palate, you know, is the roof of your mouth where peanut butter gets stuck, you know, that part. And when the children have the cleft palate, there's real problems with them breastfeeding when they're little babies. So often the kids can die of malnutrition because they just can't, you know, get enough nutrients. And then if they do make it to be older, there's really severe infection problems, sinus infections, and speech impediments. So the lip surgery or the cleft surgery, either one can take as little as an hour, but often they'll do them in stages. So they'll do the palate and then the lip. And then some children, there's one little boy in the film, and I'm not going to know exactly the right term, but where he has like, it's almost like his teeth are sort of jutting out in the front, and there's nothing sort of connecting them. And so then they have to do some more extensive, you know, and dental work and everything. But they'll, you know, they'll keep them there as long as they need to be. And but it is, I mean, one of the amazing things is that it's really a pretty simple surgery. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, Pinky was probably at the hospital for a total of 5 days. So, and one of the, you'll see a scene in the film for folks who see it, and hope everyone tunes in. they bring, because it takes so much work to get the word out to the patients that Dr. Sabode's hospital, some of the Smile Train hospitals do different strategies, but Dr. Sabode decided that they would concentrate 4 times a year at doing a real communications push. So they do flyers, they're on radio shows, they go to the train stations, bus stations, you know, do everything they can to get the word out. And then folks come in and they schedule everyone who shows up who's healthy enough for surgery gets it. No one's turned away. But they schedule folks for 3 months over. So we were fortunate in this. I mean, I'm a pretty orthodox filmmaker, but Dr. Sabode did schedule Pinky and Gertrude conveniently very quickly, but I felt like that was an okay tampering, but you know, but everybody gets a date. And then, so yeah, it's amazing that, you know, when she left her little village, I don't know if she had the idea that, you know, just 5 days later, she was going to be coming back and, you know, everything sort of had changed. And this was amazing to witness.
I know when things are ideal, surgeons like to do this when babies are quite young, 3 or 4 months old. There's one baby in the film who's turned away because it's so tiny. And, yeah. and you worry about that baby. And I don't know if yeah. you're able to, if you were able to follow it. But you look at that infant and wonder if it's going to make it a few mm-hmm. months longer.
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, a little underweight baby who's malnourished probably because of the palate. And they do give them, those parents, some supplements, you know, so that they can do as drops. And, you know, and I mean, it was the wonderful thing I loved about it. It was a different, you know, some friends who are doctors and wonderful doctors, but my experience in hospitals in the U.S. is that, you know, the doctor stops by and he has 1 foot out the door or she and 1 foot in and, you know, and there it's people sit down and talk to you and explain. So that family, actually, we saw them later, you know, got counseling about what they could do, you know, with working with the cleft palate to get their child's nutrition and weight up and then come back. And then they really do a good job of, you know, making sure they do the follow-up so that they do come back.
There's an arc throughout the film about the scarcity of food for these families. And Pinky's family in particular, we see from the beginning these are hardworking people. The dad is, when he's not with his daughter, he is always out working. But the first thing he tells us is that he barely has enough money to mm-hmm. feed his kids, and sometimes he can't feed them. Yeah. Then he's told by the social worker, the one thing you have to do is bring food with you. And then once his daughter has had the surgery, and my husband and I watched this together last night. I think we were both crying. They finally come in and tell him that it went well. And they said, why don't you get something to eat? And he can't. He's so excited. And he looks like he hasn't eaten in 3 days anyway. But he's so happy and so excited about her that that's all he can think about.
Yeah. No, I love it. He says, I'll eat after I've seen my daughter. Mm-hmm. And I like that scene on a couple. I mean, when he's sort of clutching onto her little yellow dress and I peeked out of the surgery room and I saw him doing that. I called the camera over, you know, and then and of course wanted to say to him, she's fine. You know, I sort of tried to with my eyes, but I didn't speak Hindi. But in the doctor also asking him, have you had anything to eat? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of rare. But I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, I've traveled to a lot of impoverished places in my filmmaking work, and this was a different level of that. I mean, genuinely not enough. And I mean, the ground was dry, and you know, you just saw them just trying to make whatever living they could. And when we were coming back, when I came back to shoot the epilogue, I you know, and asked for guidance on, you know, what can we bring. And we brought a big box of fruit, you know, for the village. And it was, you know, as if we'd brought a treasure chest full of gold. I mean, it was just, and of course, then they offered it all to us. And I was like, no, that's not the point. You know, mm-hmm. I have a fruit basket in my room. I mean, that disparity is really, you know, and I talk with my Indian friends and like my field producer, Nandini, you know, who's someone who's gone to graduate school in journalism and, you know, living a life pretty similar to mine, even though she lives in India. And, you know, that disparity on a daily basis is just so hard to grapple with. And I think that's something that India is grappling with right now of how do we move, you know, so far ahead on one level and bring everyone along. And, you know, I think little by little, I mean, I you know, there's some such impressive, you know, social and nonprofit NGO work happening there. You know, I hope so. But and I think Pinky's life will be forever changed. But it's, you know, the other Pinkies and the children in similar circumstances without clefts, you know, and everything is how, you know, it's their reality. But I do hope that folks who watch this film, I mean, it's exactly that, you know, that you and your husband sitting on the sofa, I'm imagining you're pretty sensitive to these mm-hmm. kind of things. But I hope every viewer can, when you hear someone talking about rural poverty, that's what it means. And it's really folks who just don't have enough to eat, or the water isn't fresh, or, you know, the well's gone dry. But there's still hope, and they're committed to education, and, you know, there is a way out, but it's not easy. I mean, I know it's, you know, documentary filmmakers can sort of be a drag to have around sometimes, always, you know, moralizing everything. I
it's
hope
way
I'm...
worse somewhere else.
but you know, it does give me some life perspective. I mean, I still fall into, you know, complaining when I miss the subway or whatever. But, you know, it just does give you like, yeah, that might be, it really isn't that bad, is it? You know, that there's just people really, really suffering. But I do think, you know, this family and even her neighbors, there's been, I think there's a little bit of a renewed optimism of them, you know, of like that that the possibilities are not limited to their existence now, that there are things outside of that. And you know, we're committed to, at least in Pinky and Gutru's case, making that so, that that the world that's been sort of opened in their mind is really available to them.
Well, there's a beautiful sort of irony in Pinky's Village, where a child like her was sort of considered, if not a curse, certainly a sign that things were not good. The attention from the film has led to some infrastructure improvements. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So it's been sort of a crazy ride. I think we were really fortunate that the film came out the same year that Slumdog Millionaire was nominated for an Oscar. I think India paid attention to the Oscars like never before. And we really, you know, rode that media excitement with them. And every time they would mention Slumdog Millionaire in the, or not every time, but very, very often, they would mention Smile Pinky too. I mean, one, you know, Hollywood blockbuster and an independent short documentary, not usually, you know, in the same articles, but it was really wonderful. I mean, they India also really took ownership of the story. You know, you could easily write it off. Oh, American director comes and tells a story about our impoverished, you know, but because the film really is all about Indians helping Indians, they really took an ownership of it. And Pinky became this, you know, little mini celebrity, and there were cameras out in her village the day we got nominated, and, you know, folks filming. Somehow they got a TV with a generator out there to watch the Academy Awards. And I mean, these folks have no concept of what the Academy, I mean, they do now, but, you know, sort of bizarre. And Pinky and Dr. Sabode and Pinky's father all came to Los Angeles with us, which, you know, the trip you see them making into town in the film is the first time they'd ever been to the city. And now they come to the U.S., which already, you know, would seem like another planet. And then to our biggest media circus we have, you know, the Academy Awards. So, but I actually think we managed to make it a good experience for them. You know, we didn't sort of over schedule them and let them, like, connect with people and families and stuff while they were here.
Is it true she fell asleep at the ceremony?
She did. She started the evening out sitting by me, and she was sitting with my parents. I was fortunate enough to be able to get tickets for my parents. And her father was sitting with my parents up high, and we had explained, you know, your dad and my dad, and they're going to be up there. But, you know, after maybe the second commercial break, I looked over and I saw her. We had come in and not really looked behind us. And I saw her sort of gazing up and seeing how big the auditorium was. And I was assuming in her eyes she was saying, "Where's my dad?" You know, and I know like three words of Hindi. And I said, "Babu," you know, which is like daddy. And she was like, "Yeah," you know. And so happily we had met all of the Slumdog Millionaire actors, and a couple of them were sitting a few rows back. The man who's the host, Amin Kapoor, I think, who's the host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in the show. And I said, "Could you say to Pinky in Hindi, you know, that I'm going to take her to see her father?" So I did, and then I got, you know, a text message down from my parents saying, "Pinky, all's well, and she's fast asleep on her dad's lap." So actually, when we were, you know, when I was up there, she was already asleep. But happily, Dr. Sabode was sitting by me, and you know, and then we had the next day together where we just got to. I had been trying to encourage them. It's not about winning. We've already won. This is a celebration of your story. You know, if being nominated, that's it. You know, and because really, it doesn't matter. I mean, for, you know, win or lose or whatever, but it was really fun to be able to, you know, have her be able to go home successful. And they all got a real hero's welcome and met with the prime minister's wife and the president and a bunch of Bollywood's, you know, big Bollywood stars have signed on to help the cause and everything. And then, as you were saying, practically, in, you know, real concrete terms, she has a scholarship offer to go to a little bit better school than the one-room schoolhouse you see in the film. The district government has made her village a model village, and they've put corrugated metal roofs, housing that will withstand the monsoons better, and an automated water pump, which is key for getting fresh water. So some real nice, you know, sort of concrete things, and electricity is on the way. So,
as you kind of mentioned before, as amazing as this is, and you don't want anything else before this village but that, you have to realize it would never have happened had you not stepped in with a camera. And that's got to make you crazy.
It does. It does on some level. I mean, I make films that often like stir up viewers' energy and desire to do something. Often a first reaction is the actual characters in the film. And concretely them. And that's really satisfying to me. I mean, those people now have big slices of my heart, and I want things to be good for them. So with my last film, it was about Sudanese refugee, both of the young men got full ride scholarships to college, you know, and lots of people reaching out to them. And that was really satisfying, but we wanted the bigger impact, and we managed to raise $1 million for refugee scholarship funds for bigger folks. I'm thrilled that Pinky and Gutru both have these scholarships, and their individual lives are better. But what will be tremendous is the attention that's been brought to clefts in the film. We're planning to do a big theatrical, or sort of a boutique theatrical release in India, followed by there's national broadcasters who have signed down, and then real grassroots work with the film, getting the film out and seen in villages so that both people can know that clefts are nothing that children have to live with for the rest of their lives, no reason to be ostracized, and figure out how to get it fixed. So knowing that, you know, thousands and thousands of more children will get this surgery because of this movie, if we do it right. I mean, that's always the thing, is you never, you know, you can just tell a story and you move people and they're emotionally moved for a moment and then they walk out of the theater, they turn their TV off and nothing happens. So you really have to make sure that you channel that energy into some real concrete impact.
Are there stories like this being told about India by Indians within the country? Is it just that we've only heard about this and about Slumdog, both of which were created by Western directors?
Oh, definitely. I mean, India has an amazing film industry. Independent documentary in any country, even Europe, where there's all sorts of funding. I mean, it's a tough haul to get exposure. I mean, even when you get the film made, that's just a tiny slice of it. And you having me on my show is a wonderful part. I mean, it takes so much energy to get an audience, because I think so many people around the world probably have the idea of, oh, a documentary is something you see in school. And, you know, so I think in India, from talking with Nandini Rajwadi, my field producer, is a producer herself in India. And, you know, she says there's very limited funding and it's a hard sell to the audience. You know, people are used to seeing Bollywood movies, or when they see independent film, it's usually, you know, foreign independent film. But there's a wonderful tradition of Indian filmmakers, you know, focusing on social issue films. And I think, you know, there's no reason. I'm happy I was the one who was invited to tell this story. And I sort of, you know, falling back on that, we all have a lot more in common than not. I mean, I feel like there was a lot of universality to this story that allowed me to not know all that much about Indian culture and still do a respectful job of it.
You could relate instantly.
It's so human, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would love, I mean, I would joke with Nandini, I was like, I wish you were making your version of this film at the same time, and then we could see, you know, the different perspectives. So, and I love doing, you know, video workshops, and I didn't have a chance to do it with this one, but video workshops, you know, in the places I filmed, to empower local filmmakers to at least get the idea that this might be a way to spend their days.
Megan Mylan is my guest. Her Academy Award-winning documentary short subject is called Smile Pinky. It will debut on HBO Wednesday, June 3rd. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Academy Award-winning filmmaker Megan Mylan. Her film is called Smile Pinky. It won the Best Documentary Short Subject this year and will debut on HBO starting Wednesday, June 3rd. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Since you were talking about the funding for documentaries and independent films and things that are not necessarily feel-good films, this one is, but they're not all. Has it gotten easier to raise the money you need to make your work?
Because of the Oscar?
Yeah.
Not yet. I don't think it's going to hurt in any ways. It's a fabulous feather in my cap kind of thing. But documentary is a very small world with limited dollars. I think what it'll do is have people who maybe weren't going to give my work a second look, give it a second look. But you know, I have a lot of respect for the funders and foundations that even turn me down, and it happens a lot. I mean, I think that's what working in any independent field is, lots and lots and lots of no's for everyone, yes. And to some degree, I wish the funding for documentary was easier and more abundant. But to some degree, it does make you you know, be certain that you're really committed to telling the story, because you're going to have to work and work and work to raise the money to do it. So, you know, so far, I mean, I don't know that there's, you know, a huge, you know, game changing impact on my career. It's been a wonderful excuse to reconnect with people from every facet of my life, to have a happy reason to be in touch with people and really share that with them. That's been tremendous. I got some really great free chocolate cake at the Italian restaurant in my neighborhood. You know, it's had those sort of and just fun to, you know, I think validate folks who invested in my work or believed in my, you know, earlier films. So, you know, but some years really great films win Oscars and some years really lousy films win Oscars. So I'm trying, you know, it doesn't I think it does give me a little bit of, it can be sort of an insecure profession. And on those days when you're thinking, am I any good at this? I think that will help. Just like, yeah, there was a moment, like, it can't be all bad if this has happened. So I'm thrilled. I mean, it's an honor, you know, and it's nice to sort of have a shorthanded way. I mean, I think it's like getting a university degree. It's a shorthanded way to say, oh, okay, this person knows what they're doing.
You get your way in the door, at least.
And get your way in the door. It's just, you know, those doors actually, I mean, there's some great, you know, there's a lot of women working in documentary, and the doors are pretty open. They're really, you know, both at HBO and at PBS, they really are open to hearing from filmmakers, and there's lots and lots of different calls for funding, you know, open calls and such. But you just have to have a great story and catch someone's and make a lot of noise, you know, catch their attention and make a lot of noise. And then it falls into place. So, you know, this is hard economic time. I actually had some funding in place for my next project, so I haven't been out fundraising yet. That I know with, you know, the way the economy is, all dollars are more limited than they already were in documentary. So, but I think people who are interested in social issues, I think, are to a greater idea realizing the impact that film can have, that, you know, letting a story that maybe, you know, doesn't hit all of the talking point messages of like a PSA would or whatever, but just telling really great stories about people living, you know, whether you're interested in clean water or immigrant issues, or but just telling slice of lives of that story so that people can emotionally connect with an issue, that then there's all sorts of great organizing that can happen around that. I think we'll hopefully, you know, increase the funding dollars that are available to documentaries.
Is it hard for you to emotionally disconnect sometimes when you're not sure of the fate of the people that you have grown so close to in these films?
Yeah. Well, you know, people always ask that, how do you keep that distance? And my strategy actually is not to keep much distance at all. I mean, I feel like I get pretty emotionally invested. I don't get hands-on invested, and that's hard. I mean, with this story, with Smile Pinky, I wasn't with them for that long. I was with them during, you know, a really intense life-changing moment in their life, and had to be respectful to, you know, get as close as I could wanted to for making the film effective, but give them their space to go through this as they would. But like the film I did on Lost Boys of Sudan, we were filming with these young men for over a year, and it's a story about two young Sudanese refugees who come to America, and we follow them through their first year of life here. And I desperately wanted – they were very lonely. There was a lot of misinformation. There were a lot of things going wrong that didn't need to go wrong. And, you know, every instinct of me as a human being just wanted to help them connect with friends, get my friends to invite them over to dinner, you know, help them find better jobs, all of that. Well, if I had done that, then it would be a story about what life is like for a newcomer with a filmmaker helping you out. So you have to keep that little bit of distance. And I mean, I had a co-director on that film, John Chenkin. You know, our bargain with each other was, when this is over, mm-hmm. we'll do everything we can to make, you know, their lives more effective. So you know, you have to keep some distance. But I mean, I think the particulars of the sorts of film stories that I tell, I sort of in my gut know that some good things are probably going to have to happen for my characters. And that also beyond their lives, that it's going to have a social impact. But it's a real sort of organic division for me. I mean, when I'm in the field, I'm a storyteller. I have my creative director's hat on. I'm not really thinking about what message is this going to send to an audience, and is it going to motivate them to sign up to volunteer, to write a check to an organization, to write their congressperson or a letter to the editor. I'm not – that piece of it happens – it happens sort of in the beginning when I'm – conceptualizing the film, and then afterwards, once the story's told. But and I think it's a really important division, that I mean, because I think you can make a really lousy film trying to make people think or feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. I guess in choosing the way into the story and choosing the character and choosing the style of the filmmaking, that's the moment that I'm sort of making some of those choices early on. What is this going to reveal? What is this issue I care about, and how can I find a story that sort of reveals it? But then sort of forgetting that and just letting the story and letting these characters' lives unfold as they are and being comfortable with the complexity, you know, and giving – I mean, one of the reasons I like this observational style of filmmaking is it lets everyone bring their own life experience to the story. So you're there watching it and your experience with it is something very different. You know, maybe you're thinking of your own relationship with your father or a journey you went on or something, and there's not someone explaining to you, you know, the significance of what you've just seen is, you know, or here's what is most important to Pinky.
Well, so. I think your films tend to surprise. It's been a few years since I've seen Lost Boys of Sudan, but if I remember correctly, I went to it sort of expecting to be, you know, struck by the harrowing kind of shadow of violence over these people. What I was not expecting was this film that turned out to be very much about the immigrant experience in this country and how jarring it is, even to go from something horrendous to come to something much better. Still, that cultural shock is something that would also affect people who hadn't come from such horrible circumstances but were in a brand new place. And I think that was sort of the brilliance of that film.
I think, yeah, I mean, I thank you. I shouldn't agree. Yes, brilliance. But no, I do think it was the accumulation of small moments. And in some ways, you know, in both cases, these characters were going through these life-defining moments. You know, Pinky with this life-changing surgery, and Peter and Santino in the Sudan film, you know, this journey from Africa to America. But in both cases, I think it's small moments. And for the Lost Boys group, and, you know, not just our two characters, but the thousands of young Sudanese refugees, the burden of just how challenging it is to build a life in this, you know, modern society we've created, and that each of those little, you know, for every one step forward, then there's two steps back. And I think even for a lot of native-born Americans, that's the case. When you're struggling, you know, in that, you know, working class, working the night shift, and, you know, there's just no safety net whatsoever. And I felt like our time spent with them was that. You felt this burden of all of these small little moments and really not having anyone reaching out and embracing you. And I think the film we constructed reveals that's just sort of that challenge. So I know I just sort of make films that are like the films I like to watch, mm-hmm. Fiction ones too. I like the films that don't explain to me, you know, every bit of the backstory, or but where I feel like I'm just sort of, you know, dropping down into someone's reality for a little while, and then I can imagine what their life is, you know, like after that.
I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of your career, because you did not enter your professional life with the intention to be a filmmaker.
Yeah. No, I always wish I had one of the, some of my filmmaker friends have these great stories about, oh, my grandfather gave me a Super 8 camera when I was, you know, 11.
It's you know, a good documentary. Right?
Right. I knew. And, you know, and I sort of fell into it. I went to high school here in Dallas, and was a kid who, you know, was part of a volunteer group in high school. I was always sort of interested in people's lives that weren't my life. I had a very happy, happy childhood, and great, but I just, you know, I just always wanted to know what other people were up to and living, and also give back. I mean, I felt very privileged. I don't know exactly, you know, it wasn't something my parents drilled into me, but, you know, my mom was a community organizer and my father's a university professor. So anyway, I ended up doing international relations in undergrad and getting involved with a nonprofit group called Ashoka that supports people working in human rights and social change all around the world. I had gone to school in D.C. I was working in their office in Rosslyn, Virginia as a fundraiser, and bored, you know. I didn't want, I was like in a room with light blue walls, you know,
disconnected from what you wanted to do.
You know, writing grant proposals for all these people doing amazing work all around the world. So I kept trying to get them to send me to the Brazil office. They wouldn't. So I quit, flew myself down, and had befriended the Brazil country. You know, because they were like, we have all these Brazilians working there. Are we going to send a 23-year-old American who barely speaks Portuguese? But I flew down, and then she hired me back, and I worked there. And that was, I just, you know, met all of these people with these amazing stories. But again, I wasn't really enjoying the role of fundraising for their work. I wanted my days to be more interesting. I wanted my days to be as interesting as theirs. And something clicked. I met some Brazilian filmmakers who were making documentaries, and something just went, ah, you know, an aha moment that I could be connected to people doing this sort of work, having a really positive impact on the world by sharing their stories. And it was satisfying to me on enough levels. One of the things I love about documentaries, you just wear all these different hats. You know, there's time to be creative. There's room where it's really more business, where you're trying to raise the money to make your films, and then the distribution side of it. And sometimes it's very solitary. If I'm sitting and sort of trying to conceptualize something and do writing, I work from home all by myself. And then other times I have this wonderful team that I get to handpick of like all of my favorite creative people, you know, who love documentary every bit as much as I do. So it has all of these levels to it. And I feel so lucky to have fallen into it. I think if I had to, plot the path, I'm not sure I could figure out exactly how I got there, but it fell into place. And I mean, I'm just thrilled to get to do what I do for a living. It's really fun.
And I guess the grant writing background turned out not to hurt.
Exactly. No. And like my whole goal was to get away from that. Now I do fundraising all of the time. But, but it's, I don't know, somehow it's worth it.
I wonder if you can talk for a minute a little bit more about the particulars of Smile Train, because mm-hmm. I wonder, I imagine people who see the film might feel motivated. First mm-hmm. of all, it doesn't take that many American dollars to make sure that a child gets a surgery.
No, it's really incredible. It's $250 on average for a surgery that takes about an hour. The Smile Train has sort of a unique strategy about this. It's actually an outgrowth. There are groups, U.S. groups, that do great work of sending American doctors and nurses abroad. And the folks who started Smile Train had been doing that and going on these medical missions where they would go for a week or so, and hundreds of children would show up, and they'd only have time to give surgery to a fraction of them. And they just sort of had this aha of like, there's no reason that local doctors all around the world, there are local doctors who are perfectly skilled to be doing this. And so what they do is they identify and, if needed, give additional training, but give support to local doctors in 76 different developing countries. Most children who are born, every child born in the U.S. can get free corrective surgery. It's covered by Medicaid. So even if you don't have health insurance, it's so almost no one has to live with it. But in the developing world, almost all children live with it. They don't get it fixed unless they come to one of these free surgery programs. So they work with these amazing network of doctors. I've now had the opportunity to meet not just Dr. Sabot, who's in the film, but lots of the other Smile Train doctors. And there's a real clear sense of mission. Most of these, a lot of them are plastic surgeons, some are oral surgeons, stuff, could be doing much more lucrative careers. Dr. Sabot had a private plastic surgery. He's from Varanasi, where the film takes place, but had studied in the U.S. And, he could have a very lucrative plastic surgery practice if he wanted to. And instead, this has become his life mission. And so they work with a really incredible quality of person. And, everybody in the hospital we were filming in, from the surgeons and anesthesiologists all the way down to the women who were cleaning the stairs, is this one woman who spends her whole day, she starts up at the top, and by the time she gets to the bottom, it's all dirty again. So she just keeps,
there's a great
Sisyphus.
Shot for someone walking right past.
I'm glad
she's
you noticed
cleaned.
That. Yeah. I put that in. I just felt so bad for her. I wanted to stop everybody. The stairs are clean. Stop going up and down, But they've journeyed for hours. Their feet are dirty. They didn't have shoes. But everyone in that hospital had such a sense of mission. And everyone who works at the Smile Train, I find the same thing. So it's that unique thing of having identified something that is, a huge common problem, totally devastating on these young lives, but has this really simple, straightforward fix to it. And so they've come up with this really efficient model of, their goal is to eradicate it, give every child who needs it surgery. So I think they will.
You can see some of that film in the documentary Smile Pinky. It won the Best Documentary Short Subject Award this year at the Academy Awards. It debuts on HBO Wednesday, June 3rd. And Megan Mylan, the filmmaker, has been my guest. Megan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.